so long that when it bursts forth, they lose control. Never give in too early and never let your guard down. Such types can be dangerous. The idol worshiper. Everyone feels an inner lack, but idol worshippers have a bigger emptiness than most people. They cannot be satisfied with themselves, so they search the world for something to worship, something to fill their inner void. This often assumes the form of a great interest in spiritual matters or in some worthwhile cause. By focusing on something supposedly elevated, they distract themselves from their own void, from what they dislike about themselves. Idol worshippers are easy to spot. They are the ones pouring their energies into some cause or religion. They often move around over the years, leaving one cult for another. The way to seduce these types is to simply become their object of worship, to take the place of the cause or religion to which they are so dedicated. At first, you may have to seem to share their spiritual interest, joining them in their worship, or perhaps exposing them to a new cause. Eventually, you will displace it. With this type, you have to hide your flaws, or at least to give them a saintly sheen. Be banal, and idol worshippers will pass you by. But mirror the qualities they aspire to have for themselves, and they will slowly transfer their adoration to you. Keep everything on an elevated plane. Let romance and religion flow into one. Keep two things in mind when seducing this type. First, they tend to have overactive minds, which can make them quite suspicious. Because they often lack physical stimulation, and because physical stimulation will distract them, give them some. A mountain trek, a boat trip, or sex will do the trick. But this takes a lot of work, for their minds are always ticking. Second, they often suffer from low self-esteem. Do not try to raise it. They will see through you, and your efforts at praising them will clash with their own self-image. They are to worship you. You are not to worship them. Idol worshippers make perfectly adequate victims in the short term, but their endless need to search will eventually lead them to look for something new to adore. The sensualist. What marks these types is not their love of pleasure, but their overactive senses. Sometimes they show this quality in their appearance, their interest in fashion, color, style. But sometimes it is more subtle. Because they are so sensitive, they are often quite shy, and they will shrink from standing out or being flamboyant. You will recognize them by how responsive they are to their environment, how they cannot stand a room without sunlight, are depressed by certain colors or excited by certain smells. They happen to live in a culture that de-emphasizes sensual experience, except perhaps for the sense of sight. And so, what the sensualist lacks is precisely enough sensual experiences to appreciate and relish. The key to seducing them is to aim for their senses, to take them to beautiful places, pay attention to detail, envelop them in spectacle, and of course, use plenty of physical lures. Sensualists, like animals, can be baited with colors and smells. Appeal to as many senses as possible, keeping your targets distracted and weak. Seductions of sensualists are often easy and quick, and you can use the same tactics again and again to keep them interested, although it's wise to vary your sensual appeals somewhat, in kind, if not in quality. That is how Cleopatra worked on Mark Antony, an inveterate sensualist. These types make superb victims, because they are relatively docile if you give them what they want. The lonely leader. Powerful people are not necessarily different from everyone else, but they are treated differently, and this has a big effect on their personalities. Everyone around them tends to be fawning and courtier-like, to have an angle, to want something from them. This makes them suspicious and distrustful, and a little hard around the edges, but do not mistake the appearance for the reality. Lonely leaders long to be seduced, to have someone break through their isolation and overwhelm them. The problem is that most people are too intimidated to try or use the kind of tactics, flattery, or charm, that they see through and despise. To seduce such types, it is better to act like their equal or even their superior, the kind of treatment they never get. If you are blunt with them, you will seem genuine and they will be touched. You care enough to be honest, even perhaps at some risk. Being blunt with the powerful can be dangerous. Lonely leaders can be made emotional by inflicting some pain, followed by tenderness. This is one of the hardest types to seduce, not only because they are suspicious, but because their minds are burdened with cares and responsibilities. They have less mental space for a seduction. You will have to be patient and clever, slowly filling their minds with thoughts of you. Succeed, though, and you can gain great power in turn, for in their loneliness, they will come to depend on you. The floating gender. All of us have a mix of the masculine and the feminine in our characters, but most of us learn to develop and exhibit the socially acceptable side while repressing the other. People of the floating gender type feel that the separation of the sexes into such distinct genders is a burden. They are sometimes thought to be repressed or latent homosexuals, but this is a misunderstanding. They may well be heterosexual, but their masculine and feminine sides are in flux. And because this may discomfit others if they show it, they learn to repress it, perhaps by going to one extreme. They would actually love to be able to play with their gender, to give full expression to both sides. Many people fall into this type without its being obvious. A woman may have a masculine energy, a man a developed aesthetic side. Don't look for obvious signs, because these types often go underground, keeping it under wraps. This makes them vulnerable to a powerful seduction. What floating gender types are really looking for is another person of uncertain gender, their counterpart from the opposite sex. Show them that in your presence, and they can relax. Express the repressed side of their character. If you have such proclivities, this is the one instance where it would be best to seduce the same type of the opposite sex. Each person will stir up repressed desires in the other, and will suddenly have license to explore all kinds of gender combinations, without fear of judgment. If you are not of the floating gender, leave this type alone. You will only inhibit them and create more discomfort. Part 2. The Seductive Process. Most of us understand that certain actions on our part will have a pleasing and seductive effect on the person we would like to seduce. The problem is that we are generally too self-absorbed. We think more about what we want from others than what they could want from us. We may occasionally do something that is seductive, but often we follow this up with a selfish or aggressive action. We're in a hurry to get what we want. Or, unaware of what we're doing, we show a side of ourselves that is petty and banal, deflating any illusions or fantasies a person might have about us. Our attempts at seduction usually don't last long enough to create much of an effect. You will not seduce anyone by simply depending on your engaging personality, or by occasionally doing something noble or alluring. Seduction is a process that occurs over time. The longer you take and the slower you go, the deeper you will penetrate into the mind of your victim. It is an art that requires patience, focus, and strategic thinking. You need to always be one step ahead of your victim, throwing dust in their eyes, casting a spell, keeping them off balance. The 24 chapters in this section will arm you with a series of tactics that will help you get out of yourself and into the mind of your victim, so that you can play it like an instrument. The chapters are placed in a loose order, going from the initial contact with your victim to the successful conclusion. This order is based on certain timeless laws of human psychology. Because people's thoughts tend to revolve around their daily concerns and insecurities, you cannot proceed with a seduction until you slowly put their anxieties to sleep and fill their distracted minds with thoughts of you. The opening chapters will help you accomplish this. There is a natural tendency in relationships for people to become so familiar with one another that boredom and stagnation set in. Mystery is the lifeblood of seduction, and to maintain it, you have to constantly surprise your victims, stir things up, even shock them. A seduction should never settle into a comfortable routine. The middle and later chapters will instruct you in the art of alternating hope and despair, pleasure and pain, until your victims weaken and succumb. In each instance, one tactic is setting up the next one, allowing you to push it further with something bolder and more violent. A seducer cannot be timid or merciful. To help you move the seduction along, the chapters are arranged in four phases, each phase with a particular goal to aim for. Getting the victim to think of you. Gaining access to their emotions by creating moments of pleasure and confusion. Going deeper by working on their unconscious, stirring up repressed desires. And finally, inducing physical surrender. The phases are clearly marked and explained with a short introduction. By following these phases, you will work more effectively on your victim's mind and create the slow and hypnotic pace of a ritual. In fact, the seductive process may be thought of as a kind of initiation ritual in which you are uprooting people from their habits, giving them novel experiences, putting them through tests before initiating them into a new life. It is best to read all of the chapters and gain as much knowledge as possible. When it comes time to apply these tactics, you will want to pick and choose which ones are appropriate for your particular victim. Sometimes only a few are sufficient, depending on the level of resistance you meet and the complexity of your victim's problems. These tactics are equally applicable to social and political seductions, minus the sexual component in phase four. At all cost, resist the temptation to hurry to the climax of your seduction or to improvise. You are not being seductive, but selfish. Everything in daily life is hurried and improvised, and you need to offer something different. By taking your time and respecting the seductive process, you will not only break down your victim's resistance, you will make them fall in love. Phase 1. Separation. Stirring interest and desire. Your victims live in their own worlds, their minds occupied with anxieties and daily concerns. Your goal in this initial phase is to slowly separate them from that closed world and fill their minds with thoughts of you. Once you have decided whom to seduce, chapter 1, choose the right victim, your first task is to get your victim's attention, to stir interest in you. For those who might be more resistant or difficult, you should try a slower and more insidious approach. First, winning their friendship, chapter 2, create a false sense of security, approach indirectly. For those who are bored and less difficult to reach, a more dramatic approach will work, either fascinating them with a mysterious presence, chapter 3, send mixed signals, or seeming to be someone who is coveted and fought over by others, chapter 4, appear to be an object of desire. Once the victim is properly intrigued, you need to transform their interest into something stronger, desire. Desire is generally preceded by feelings of emptiness, of something missing inside that needs fulfillment. You must deliberately instill such feelings, make your victims aware of the adventure and romance that are lacking in their lives. Chapter 5, create a need, stir anxiety and discontent. If they see you as the one to fill their emptiness, interest will blossom into desire. The desire should be stoked by subtly planting ideas in their minds, hints of the seductive pleasures that await them. Chapter 6, Master the Art of Insinuation. Mirroring your victim's values, indulging them in their wants and moods will charm and delight them. Chapter 7, Enter Their Spirit. Without realizing how it has happened, more and more of their thoughts now revolve around you. The time has come for something stronger. Lure them with an irresistible pleasure or adventure. Chapter 8, Create Temptation. And they will follow your lead. Chapter 1, Choose the Right Victim. Everything depends on the target of your seduction. Study your prey thoroughly and choose only those who will prove susceptible to your charms. The right victims are those for whom you can fill a void, who see in you something exotic. They are often isolated, or at least somewhat unhappy, perhaps because of recent adverse circumstances, or can easily be made so. For the completely contented person is almost impossible to seduce. The perfect victim has some natural quality that attracts you. The strong emotions this quality inspires will help make your seductive maneuvers seem more natural and dynamic. The perfect victim allows for the perfect chase. Preparing for the hunt. The young Vicomte de Valmont was a notorious libertine in the Paris of the 1770s, the ruin of many a young girl and the ingenious seducer of the wives of illustrious aristocrats. But after a while, the repetitiveness of it all began to bore him. His successes came too easily. So one year, during the sweltering slow month of August, he decided to take a break from Paris and visit his aunt at her chateau in the provinces. Life there was not what he was used to. There were country walks, chats with the local vicar, card games. His city friends, particularly his fellow libertine and confidant, the Marquise de Merteuil, expected him to hurry back. There were other guests at the chateau, however, including the Présidente de Tourvel, a 22-year-old woman whose husband was temporarily absent, having work to do elsewhere. The Présidente had been languishing at the chateau, waiting for him to join her. Valmont had met her before. She was certainly beautiful, but had a reputation as a prude, who was extremely devoted to her husband. She was not a court lady. Her taste in clothing was atrocious. She always covered her neck with ghastly frills, and her conversation lacked wit. For some reason, however, far from Paris, Valmont began to see these traits in a new light. He followed her to the chapel where she went every morning to pray. He caught glimpses of her at dinner or playing cards. Unlike the ladies of Paris, she seemed unaware of her charms. This excited him. Because of the heat, she wore a simple linen dress which revealed her figure. A piece of muslin covered her breasts, letting him more than imagine them. Her hair, unfashionable in its slight disorder, conjured the bedroom. And her face, he had never noticed how expressive it was. Her features lit up when she gave alms to a beggar. She blushed at the slightest praise. She was so natural and unself-conscious, and when she talked of her husband or religious matters, he could sense the depth of her feelings. If such a passionate nature were ever detoured into a love affair. Valmont extended his stay at the chateau, much to the delight of his aunt, who could not have guessed at the reason. And he wrote to the Marquise de Merteuil, explaining his new ambition to seduce Madame de Tourvel. The Marquise was incredulous. He wanted to seduce this prude? If he succeeded, how little pleasure she would give him. And if he failed, what a disgrace! The great libertine unable to seduce a wife whose husband was far away. She wrote a sarcastic letter, which only inflamed Valmont further. The conquest of this notoriously virtuous woman would prove his greatest seduction. His reputation would only be enhanced. There was an obstacle, though, that seemed to make success almost impossible. Everyone knew Valmont's reputation, including the présidente. She knew how dangerous it was to ever be alone with him, how people would talk about the least association with him. Valmont did everything to belie his reputation, even going so far as to attend church services and seem repentant of his ways. The présidente noticed, but still kept her distance. The challenge she presented to Valmont was irresistible, but could he meet it? Valmont decided to test the waters. One day he arranged a little walk with the présidente and his aunt. He chose a delightful path that they had never taken before, but at a certain point they reached a little ditch, unsuitable for a lady to cross on her own. And yet, Valmont said, the rest of the walk was too nice for them to turn back, and he gallantly picked up his aunt in his arms and carried her across the ditch, making the présidente laugh uproariously. But then it was her turn, and Valmont purposefully picked her up a little awkwardly, so that she caught at his arms, and while he was holding her against him, he could feel her heart beating faster, and saw her blush. His aunt saw this too, and cried out, "The child is afraid." But Valmont sensed otherwise. Now he knew that the challenge could be met, that the présidente could be won. The seduction could proceed. Interpretation. Valmont, the présidente de Tourvel, and the marquise de Merteuil are all characters in the 18th century French novel Dangerous Liaisons by Chaudherlot de Laclos. The character of Valmont was inspired by several real-life libertines of the time, most prominent of all the Duc de Richelieu. In the story, Valmont worries that his seductions have become mechanical. He makes a move, and the woman almost always responds the same way. But no two seductions should be the same. A different target should change the whole dynamic. Valmont's problem is that he is always seducing the same type, the wrong type. He realizes this when he meets Madame de Tourvel. It's not because her husband is a count that he decides to seduce her, or because she is stylishly dressed, or is desired by other men, the usual reasons. He chooses her because, in her unconscious way, she has already seduced him. A bare arm, an unrehearsed laugh, a playful manner, all these have captured his attention, because none of them is contrived. Once he falls under her spell, the strength of his desire will make his subsequent maneuvers seem less calculated. He is apparently unable to help himself, and his strong emotions will slowly infect her. Beyond the effect the présidente has on Valmont, she has other traits that make her the perfect victim. She is bored, which draws her toward adventure. She is naive and unable to see through his tricks. Finally, the Achilles heel. She believes herself immune to seduction. Almost all of us are vulnerable to the attractions of other people, and we take precautions against unwanted lapses. Madame de Tourvel takes none. Once Valmont has tested her at the ditch and has seen she is physically vulnerable, he knows that eventually she will fall. Life is short, and should not be wasted pursuing and seducing the wrong people. The choice of target is critical. It is the setup of the seduction, and it will determine everything else that follows. The perfect victim does not have certain facial features, or the same taste in music, or similar goals in life. That is how a banal seducer chooses his or her targets. The perfect victim is the person who stirs you in a way that cannot be explained in words, whose effect on you has nothing to do with superficialities. He or she often has a quality that you yourself lack and may even secretly envy. The présidente, for example, has an innocence that Valmont long ago lost or never had. There should be a little bit of tension. The victim may fear you a little, even slightly dislike you. Such tension is full of erotic potential and will make the seduction much livelier. Be more creative in choosing your prey, and you will be rewarded with a more exciting seduction. Of course, it means nothing if the potential victim is not open to your influence. Test the person first. Once you feel that he or she is also vulnerable to you, then the hunting can begin. Keys to seduction. Throughout life, we find ourselves having to persuade people to seduce them. Some will be relatively open to our influence, if only in subtle ways, while others seem impervious to our charms. Perhaps we find this a mystery beyond our control, but that is an ineffective way of dealing with life. Seducers, whether sexual or social, prefer to pick the odds. As often as possible, they go toward people who betray some vulnerability to them and avoid the ones who cannot be moved. To leave people who are inaccessible to you alone is a wise path. You cannot seduce everyone. On the other hand, you must actively hunt out the prey that responds the right way. This will make your seductions that much more pleasurable and satisfying. How do you recognize your victims? By the way they respond to you. You should not pay so much attention to their conscious responses. A person who is obviously trying to please or charm you is probably playing to your vanity and wants something from you. Instead, pay greater attention to those responses outside conscious control. A blush, an involuntary mirroring of some gesture of yours, an unusual shyness, even, perhaps, a flash of anger or resentment. All of these show that you are having an effect on a person who is open to your influence. Like Valmont, you can also recognize the right targets by the effect they are having on you. Perhaps they make you uneasy. Perhaps they correspond to a deep-rooted childhood ideal, or represent some kind of personal taboo that excites you, or suggests the person you imagine you would be if you were the opposite sex. When a person has such a deep effect on you, it transforms all of your subsequent maneuvers. Your face and gestures become more animated. You have more energy. When victims resist you, as a good victim should, you, in turn, will be more creative, more motivated to overcome their resistance. The seduction will move forward like a good play. Your strong desire will infect the target and give them the dangerous sensation that they have a power over you. Of course, you are the one ultimately in control, since you are making your victims emotional at the right moments, leading them back and forth. Good seducers choose targets that inspire them, but they know how and when to restrain themselves. Never rush into the waiting arms of the first person who seems to like you. That is not seduction, but insecurity. The need that draws you will make for a low-level attachment, and interest on both sides will sag. Look at the types you have not considered before. That is where you will find challenge and adventure. Experienced hunters do not choose their prey by how easily it is caught. They want the thrill of the chase, a life and death struggle. The fiercer, the better. Although the victim who is perfect for you depends on you, certain types lend themselves to a more satisfying seduction. Casanova liked young women who were unhappy or had suffered a recent misfortune. Such women appealed to his desire to play the savior, but it also responded to necessity. Happy people are much harder to seduce. Their contentment makes them inaccessible. It's always easier to fish in troubled waters. Also, an air of sadness is itself quite seductive. Genji, the hero of the Japanese novel The Tale of Genji, could not resist a woman with a melancholic air. In Kierkegaard's book, The Seducer's Diary, the narrator, Johannes, has one main requirement in his victim. She must have imagination. That is why he chooses a woman who lives in a fantasy world, a woman who will envelop his every gesture in poetry, imagining far more than is there. Just as it's hard to seduce a person who's happy, it's hard to seduce a person who has no imagination. For women, the manly man is often the perfect victim. Mark Antony was of this type. He loved pleasure, was quite emotional, and when it came to women, found it hard to think straight. He was easy for Cleopatra to manipulate. Once she gained a hold on his emotions, she kept him permanently on a string. A woman should never be put off by a man who seems overly aggressive. He is often the perfect victim. It's easy, with a few coquettish tricks, to turn that aggression around and make him your slave. Such men actually enjoy being made to chase after a woman. Be careful with appearances. The person who seems volcanically passionate is often hiding insecurity and self-involvement. This was what most men failed to perceive in the 19th century courtesan Lola Montez. She seemed so dramatic, so exciting. In fact, she was a troubled, self-obsessed woman, but by the time men discovered this, it was too late. They had become involved with her and could not extricate themselves without months of drama and torture. People who are outwardly distant or shy are often better targets than extroverts. They are dying to be drawn out, and still waters run deep. People with a lot of time on their hands are extremely susceptible to seduction. They have mental space for you to fill. Tullia d'Aragona, the infamous 16th century Italian courtesan, preferred young men as her victims. Besides the physical reason for such a preference, they were more idle than working men with careers, and therefore more defenseless against an ingenious seductress. On the other hand, you should generally avoid people who are preoccupied with business or work. Seduction demands attention, and busy people have too little space in their minds for you to occupy. According to Freud, seduction begins early in life, in our relationship with our parents. They seduce us physically, both with bodily contact and by satisfying desires such as hunger, and we in turn try to seduce them into paying us attention. We are creatures by nature vulnerable to seduction throughout our lives. We all want to be seduced. We yearn to be drawn out of ourselves, out of our routines, and into the drama of Eros. And what draws us more than anything is the feeling that someone has something we don't, a quality we desire. Your perfect victims are often people who think you have something they don't, and who will be enchanted to have it provided for them. Such victims may have a temperament quite the opposite of yours, and this difference will create an exciting tension. When Jiang Qing, later known as Madame Mao, first met Mao Zedong in 1937 in his mountain retreat in western China, she could sense how desperate he was for a bit of color and spice in his life. All the camp's women dressed like the men and abjured any feminine finery. Jiang had been an actress in Shanghai and was anything but austere. She supplied what he lacked, and she also gave him the added thrill of being able to educate her in communism, appealing to his Pygmalion complex, the desire to dominate, control, and remake a person. In fact, it was Jiang Qing who controlled her future husband. The greatest lack of all is excitement and adventure, which is precisely what seduction offers. In 1964, the Chinese actor Shi Pei Pu, a man who had gained fame as a female impersonator, met Bernard Bourisco, a young diplomat assigned to the French embassy in China. Bourisco had come to China looking for adventure and was disappointed to have little contact with Chinese people. Pretending to be a woman who, when still a child, had been forced to live as a boy, supposedly the family already had too many daughters, Shi Pei Pu used the young Frenchman's boredom and discontent to manipulate him. Inventing a story of the deceptions he had to go through, he slowly drew Bourisco into an affair that would last many years. Urisku had had previous homosexual encounters, but considered himself heterosexual. Eventually, the diplomat was led into spying for the Chinese. All the while, he believed Shi Pei Pu was a woman. His yearning for adventure had made him that vulnerable. Repressed types are perfect victims for a deep seduction. People who repress the appetite for pleasure make ripe victims, particularly later in their lives. The 8th century Chinese emperor Ming Huang spent much of his reign trying to rid his court of its costly addiction to luxuries, and was himself a model of austerity and virtue. But the moment he saw the concubine Yang Guifei bathing in the palace lake, everything changed. The most charming woman in the realm, she was the mistress of his son. Exerting his power, the emperor won her away, only to become her abject slave. The choice of the right victim is equally important in politics. Mass seducers such as Napoleon or John F. Kennedy offer their public just what it lacks. When Napoleon came to power, the French people's sense of pride was beaten down by the bloody aftermath of the French Revolution. He offered them glory and conquest. Kennedy recognized that Americans were bored with the stultifying comfort of the Eisenhower years. He gave them adventure and risk. More important, he tailored his appeal to the group most vulnerable to it, the younger generation. Successful politicians know that not everyone will be susceptible to their charm, but if they can find a group of believers with a need to be filled, they have supporters who will stand by them no matter what. Reversal. There is no possible reversal. There is nothing to be gained from trying to seduce the person who is closed to you or who cannot provide the pleasure and chase that you need. Chapter 2. Create a false sense of security. Approach indirectly. If you are too direct early on, you risk stirring up a resistance that will never be lowered. At first, there must be nothing of the seducer in your manner. The seduction should begin at an angle, indirectly, so that the target only gradually becomes aware of you. Haunt the periphery of your target's life, approach through a third party, or seem to cultivate a relatively neutral relationship, moving gradually from friend to lover. Arrange an occasional chance encounter, as if you and your target were destined to become acquainted. Nothing is more seductive than a sense of destiny. Lull the target into feeling secure, then strike. Friend to lover. Anne-Marie Louis d'Orléans, the Duchess de Montpensier, known in 17th century France as La Grande Mademoiselle, had never known love in her life. Her mother had died when she was young, her father remarried and ignored her. She came from one of Europe's most illustrious families. Her grandfather had been King Henry IV. The future King Louis XIV was her cousin. When she was young, matches had been proposed between her and the widowed King of Spain, the son of the Holy Roman Emperor, and even Cousin Louis himself, among many others. But all of these matches were designed for political purposes, or because of her family's enormous wealth. No one bothered to woo her. She rarely even met her suitors. To make matters worse, the Grande Mademoiselle was an idealist, who believed in the old-fashioned values of chivalry, courage, honesty, virtue. She loathed the schemers whose motives in courting her were dubious at best. Whom could she trust? One by one, she found a reason to spurn them. Spinsterhood seemed to be her fate. In April of 1669, the Grande Mademoiselle, then 42, met one of the strangest men in court, the Marquis Antonin Peguilhan, later known as the Duc de Lauzun. A favorite of Louis XIV's, the 36-year-old Marquis was a brave soldier with an acid wit. He was also an incurable Don Juan. Although he was short and certainly not handsome, his impudent manners and his military exploits made him irresistible to women. The Grande Mademoiselle had noticed him some years before, admiring his elegance and boldness, but it was only this time, in 1669, that she had a real conversation with him, if a short one, and although she knew of his lady-killer reputation, she found him charming. A few days later, they ran into each other again. This time, the conversation was longer, and Lauzun proved more intelligent than she had imagined. They talked of the playwright Corneille, her favorite, of heroism, and of other elevated topics. Now, their encounters became more frequent. They had become friends. Anne-Marie noted in her diary that her conversations with Lauzun, when they occurred, were the highlight of her day. When he was not at court, she felt his absence. Surely her encounters with him came frequently enough that they couldn't be accidental on his part, but he always seemed surprised to see her. At the same time, she recorded feeling uneasy. Strange emotions were stealing up on her. She didn't know why. Time passed, and the Grande Mademoiselle was to leave Paris for a week or two. Now Lauzun approached her without warning and made an emotional plea to be considered her confidant, the great friend who would execute any commission she needed done while she was away. He was poetic and chivalrous, but what did he really mean? In her diary, Anne-Marie finally confronted the emotions that had been stirring in her since their first conversation. Quote, "I told myself, these are not vague musings. There must be an object to all of these feelings, and I could not imagine who it was. Finally, after troubling myself with this for several days, I realized that it was the Marquis de Lauzun whom I loved. It was he who had somehow slipped into my heart and captured it." Unquote. Made aware of the source of her feelings, the Grande Mademoiselle became more direct. If Lauzun was to be her confidant, she could talk to him of marriage, of the matches that were still being offered to her. The topic might give him a chance to express his feelings. Perhaps he might show jealousy. Unfortunately, Lauzun did not seem to take the hint. Instead, he asked her why she was thinking of marriage at all. She seemed so happy. Besides, who could possibly be worthy of her? This went on for weeks. She could pry nothing personal out of him. In a way, she understood. There were the differences in rank, she was far above him, and age, she was 6 years older. Then, a few months later, the wife of the king's brother died, and King Louis suggested to the Grande Mademoiselle that she replace his late sister-in-law, that is, that she marry his brother. Anne-Marie was disgusted. Clearly, the brother was trying to get his hands on her fortune. She asked Lauzun his opinion. As the king's loyal servants, he replied, they must obey the royal wish. His answer did not please her, and to make things worse, he stopped visiting her, as if it were no longer proper for them to be friends. This was the last straw. The Grande Mademoiselle told the king she would not marry his brother, and that was that. Now Anne-Marie met with Lauzun and told him she would write on a piece of paper the name of the man she had wanted to marry all along. He was to put the paper under his pillow and read it the next morning. When he did, he found the words, "C'est vous." It is you. Seeing the Grande Mademoiselle the following evening, Lauzun said she must have been joking. She would make him the laughingstock of the court. She insisted that she was serious. He seemed shocked, surprised, but not as surprised as the rest of the court was a few weeks later when an engagement was announced between this relatively low-ranking Don Juan and the second-highest-ranking lady in France, a woman known for both her virtue and her skill at defending it.
Interpretation. The Duc de Lauzun was one of the greatest seducers in history, and his slow and steady seduction of the Grande Mademoiselle was his masterpiece. His method was simple: indirection. Sensing her interest in him in that first conversation, he decided to beguile her with friendship. He would become her most devoted friend. At first, this was charming. A man was taking the time to talk to her of poetry, history, the deeds of war, her favorite subjects. She slowly began to confide in him. Then, almost without her realizing it, her feelings shifted. The consummate ladies' man was only interested in friendship? He was not attracted to her as a woman? Such thoughts made her aware that she had fallen in love with him. This, in part, was what eventually made her turn down the match with the king's brother. A decision cleverly and indirectly provoked by Lauzun himself, when he stopped visiting her. And how could he be after money or position or sex when he had never made any kind of move? No, the brilliance of Lauzun's seduction was that the Grande Mademoiselle believed it was she who was making all the moves. Once you have chosen the right victim, you must get his or her attention and stir desire. To move from friendship to love can win success without calling attention to itself as a maneuver. First, your friendly conversations with your targets will bring you valuable information about their characters, their tastes, their weaknesses, the childhood yearnings that govern their adult behavior. Lauzun, for example, could adapt cleverly to Anne-Marie's tastes once he had studied her close up. Second, by spending time with your targets, you can make them comfortable with you. Believing you're interested only in their thoughts, in their company, they will lower their resistance, dissipating the usual tension between the sexes. Now they are vulnerable, for your friendship with them has opened the golden gate to their body, their mind. At this point, any offhand comment, any slight physical contact, will spark a different thought, which will catch them off guard. Perhaps there could be something else between you. Once that feeling has stirred, they will wonder why you haven't made a move, and will take the initiative themselves, enjoying the illusion that they are in control. There is nothing more effective in seduction than making the seduced think that they are the ones doing the seducing. Key to seduction. What you're after as a seducer is the ability to move people in the direction you want them to go. But the game is perilous. The moment they suspect they're acting under your influence, they will become resentful. We are creatures who cannot stand feeling that we're obeying someone else's will. Should your targets catch on, sooner or later, they will turn against you. But what if you can make them do what you want them to do without their realizing it? What if they think they are in control? That is the power of indirection, and no seducer can work his or her magic without it. The first move to master is simple. Once you have chosen the right person, you must make the target come to you. If, in the opening stages, you can make your targets think that they are the ones making the first approach, you have won the game. There will be no resentment, no perverse counter-reaction, no paranoia. To make them come to you requires giving them space. This can be accomplished in several ways. You can haunt the periphery of their existence, letting them notice you in different places, but never approaching them. You will get their attention this way, and if they want to bridge the gap, they will have to come to you. You can befriend them, as Lauzun did the Grande Mademoiselle, moving steadily closer while always maintaining the distance appropriate for friends of the opposite sex. You can also play cat and mouse with them, first seeming interested, then stepping back, actively luring them to follow you into your web. Whatever you do, and whatever kind of seduction you're practicing, you must at all cost avoid the natural tendency to crowd your targets. Do not make the mistake of thinking they will lose interest unless you apply pressure, or that they will enjoy a flood of attention. Too much attention early on will actually just suggest insecurity and raise doubts as to your motives. Worst of all, it gives your targets no room for imagination. Take a step back.
Let the thoughts you are provoking come to them as if they were their own. This is doubly important if you're dealing with someone who has a deep effect on you. We can never really understand the opposite sex. They are always mysterious to us, and it is this mystery that provides the tension so delightful in seduction. But it is also a source of unease. Freud famously wondered what women really wanted. Even to this most insightful of psychological thinkers, the opposite sex was a foreign land. For both men and women, there are deep-rooted feelings of fear and anxiety in relation to the opposite sex. In the initial stages of a seduction, then, you must find ways to calm any sense of mistrust that the other person may experience. A sense of danger and fear can heighten the seduction later on, but if you stir such emotions in the first stages, you will more likely scare the target away. Establish a neutral distance. Seem harmless, and you give yourself room to move. Casanova cultivated a slight femininity in his character, an interest in clothes, theater, domestic manners, that young girls found comforting. The Renaissance courtesan Tullia d'Aragona, developing friendships with the great thinkers and poets of her time, talked of literature and philosophy, anything but the boudoir, and anything but the money that was also her goal. Johannes, the narrator of Soren Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, follows his target, Cordelia, from a distance. When their paths cross, he is polite and apparently shy. As Cordelia gets to know him, he doesn't frighten her. In fact, he is so innocuous, she begins to wish he were less so. Duke Ellington, the great jazz artist and a consummate seducer, would initially dazzle the ladies with his good looks, stylish clothing, and charisma. But once he was alone with a woman, he would take a slight step back, becoming excessively polite, making only small talk. Banal conversation can be a brilliant tactic. It hypnotizes the target. The dullness of your front gives the subtlest suggestive word, the slightest look, an amplified power. Never mention love, and you make its absence speak volumes. Your victims will wonder why you never discuss your emotions. And as they have such thoughts, they will go further, imagining what else is going on in your mind. They will be the ones to bring up the topic of love or affection. Deliberate dullness has many applications. In psychotherapy, the doctor makes monosyllabic responses to draw patients in, making them relax and open up. In international negotiations, Henry Kissinger would lull diplomats with boring details, then strike with bold demands. Early in a seduction, less colorful words are often more effective than vivid ones. The target tunes them out, looks at your face, begins to imagine, fantasize, fall under your spell. Getting to your targets through other people is extremely effective. Infiltrate their circle, and you are no longer a stranger. Before the 17th century seducer Count de Gramont made a move, he would befriend his target's chambermaid, her valet, a friend, even a lover. In this way, he could gather information, finding a way to approach her in an unthreatening manner. He could also plant ideas, saying things the third party was likely to repeat, things that would intrigue the lady, particularly when they came from someone she knew. Ninon de l'Enclos, the 17th century courtesan and strategist of seduction, believed that disguising one's intentions was not only a necessity, it added to the pleasure of the game. A man should never declare his feelings, she felt, particularly early on. It is irritating and provokes mistrust. A woman is much better persuaded that she is loved by what she guesses than by what she is told, Ninon once remarked. Often, a person's haste in declaring his or her feelings comes from a false desire to please, thinking this will flatter the other. But the desire to please can annoy and offend. Children, cats, and coquettes draw us to them by apparently not trying, even by seeming uninterested. Learn to disguise your feelings and let people figure out what is happening for themselves.
In all arenas of life, you should never give the impression that you are angling for something. That will raise a resistance that you will never lower. Learn to approach people from the side. Mute your colors. Blend in. Seem unthreatening. And you will have more room to maneuver later on. The same holds true in politics, where overt ambition often frightens people. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, at first glance, looked like an everyday Russian. He dressed like a worker, spoke with a peasant accent, had no air of greatness. This made the public feel comfortable and identify with him. Yet beneath this apparently bland appearance, of course, was a deeply clever man who was always maneuvering. By the time people realized this, it was too late. Reversal. In warfare, you need space to align your troops, room to maneuver. The more space you have, the more intricate your strategy can be. But sometimes it is better to overwhelm the enemy, giving them no time to think or react. Although Casanova adapted his strategies to the woman in question, he would often try to make an immediate impression, stirring her desire at the first encounter. Perhaps he would perform some gallantry, rescuing a woman in danger. Perhaps he would dress so that his target would notice him in a crowd. In either case, once he had the woman's attention, he would move with lightning speed. A siren, like Cleopatra, tries to have an immediate physical effect on men, giving her victims no time or space to retreat. She uses the element of surprise. The first period of your contact with someone can involve a level of desire that will never be repeated. Boldness will carry the day. But these are short seductions. The sirens and the Casanovas only get pleasure from the number of their victims, moving quickly from conquest to conquest, and this can be tiring. Casanova burned himself out. Sirens, insatiable, are never satisfied. The indirect, carefully constructed seduction may reduce your number of conquests, but more than compensate by their quality.
Chapter 3. Send Mixed Signals. Once people are aware of your presence, and perhaps vaguely intrigued, you need to stir their interest before it settles on someone else. What is obvious and striking may attract their attention at first, but that attention is often short-lived. In the long run, ambiguity is much more potent. Most of us are much too obvious. Instead, be hard to figure out. Send mixed signals, both tough and tender, both spiritual and earthy, both innocent and cunning. A mix of qualities suggests depth, which fascinates even as it confuses. An elusive, enigmatic aura will make people want to know more, drawing them into your circle. Create such a power by hinting at something contradictory within you. Good and bad. In 1806, when Prussia and France were at war, Auguste, the handsome 24-year-old Prince of Prussia and nephew of Frederick the Great, was captured by Napoleon. Instead of locking him up, Napoleon allowed him to wander around French territory, keeping a close watch on him through spies. The prince was devoted to pleasure and spent his time moving from town to town, seducing young girls. In 1807, he decided to visit the Château de Coppée in Switzerland, where lived the great French writer Madame de Stael. Auguste was greeted by his hostess with as much ceremony as she could muster. After she had introduced him to her other guests, they all retired to a drawing room where they talked of Napoleon's war in Spain, the current Paris fashions, and so on. Suddenly, the door opened, and another guest entered, a woman who had somehow stayed in her room during the hubbub of the prince's entrance. It was the 30-year-old Madame Récamier, Madame de Stael's closest friend. She introduced herself to the prince, then quickly retired to her bedroom. Auguste had known that Madame Récamier was at the chateau. In fact, he had heard many stories about this infamous woman,
who, in the years after the French Revolution, was considered the most beautiful in France. Men had gone wild over her, particularly at balls when she would take off her evening wrap, revealing the diaphanous white dresses that she had made famous, and dance with such abandon. The painters Gerard and David had immortalized